Capital Allocators is brought to you by 10East, an investment platform for sophisticated investors to access private markets. 10East brings benefits of having your own family office without the cost and headaches of doing so. It's founded and led by Michael LaFell, former deputy executive managing member of Davidson Kempner. Michael and his investment team offer members the opportunity to co-invest by offering at their discretion. Michael and his team source, diligence, and commit material personal capital to each investment. The opportunities shared on the 10East platform offer exposure to private credit, real estate, niche venture and private equity, and other idiosyncratic investments that typically aren't available through traditional channels. The principals have over a decade track record of investing in these types of exposures across more than 350 transactions. Post-investment, the 10East team conducts ongoing monitoring and reporting, just as you'd expect from an institutional investment organization. I've known Michael for about a decade, and after becoming impressed by the quality of 10East offerings, its research process, and high-quality investment team, I became an advisor to the organization and investor in multiple offerings. You can learn more and join me as a member at 10east.co. That's the number 10east.co. Capital Allocators is brought to you by SRS Aquium. Since 2007, SRS Aquium has been obsessed with a single purpose: to simplify the administration of M&A deals so that deal parties and their advisors can focus on bigger issues. SRS Aquium was the pioneer in professional shareholder representation, digital M&A payments, and online stockholder solicitation, and they continue to raise bars and set industry standards. Case in point, their new VDR, which is changing the way deal parties think about virtual data rooms. No more tracking down thumb drives or asking how the VDR bill got so high. SRS Aquium keeps deal documents securely stored on the cloud for as long as you want for one flat rate. And working with SRS Aquium means you get the simplicity and stability of a single best-in-class partner from the pitch book through the last dollar out. 50% of U.S. private equity firms and 40% of venture capital firms worldwide count on SRS Aquium to optimize their deal process. To learn more about how SRS Aquium is simply the smartest way to run a deal, head to srsaquium.com. That's srsaquium.com. Hello, I'm Ted Seides, and this is Capital Allocators. This show is an open exploration of the people and process behind capital allocation. Through conversations with leaders in the money game, we learn how these holders of the keys to the kingdom allocate their time and their capital. You can join our mailing list and access premium content at capitalallocators.com.
All opinions expressed by Ted and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Capital Allocators or their firms. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Capital Allocators or podcast guests may maintain positions in securities discussed on this podcast.
My guest on today's show is Michael LaFell, the managing member of Portage Partners, chairman of Canoe Intelligence, and founder and chairman of 10East, an investment platform for sophisticated investors to access private markets by co-investing alongside Michael and his team. Michael was former deputy executive managing member of Davidson Kempner, where he spent 21 years before retiring in 2010. He formed a family office shortly thereafter and developed Portage, Canoe, and 10East out of his investing activities. Our conversation covers Michael's professional investment career, personal investing following his retirement, and businesses created from those activities. And a little disclaimer's in order. I've known Michael for about a decade, and after becoming impressed by the quality of 10East offerings, its research process, and high-quality investment team, I became an advisor to the organization and an investor in multiple offerings. Before we get going, I doubt you remember the 1996 movie starring John Travolta called Michael. His character is an archangel sent to Earth to mend wounded hearts. I don't remember much about the movie, nor should you, as I don't think it was all that great. But I do remember one line when Travolta's questioned about his angelic status while smoking a cigarette. He replies, "I'm not that kind of angel." Now, we've had a particularly good run of guests on the show of late, and you might have noticed an unusual trend. Three of the last four Monday guests are all named Michael, and all four subjects are Michaels. First Mobison, then two on Milken, and now LaFell. All three legends in the business, all three with incredible experience and wisdom to share, and all three with a first name in common. We all recognize there's a diversity issue in the industry, and usually that refers to a lack of women. And we also think about ethnic and racial diversity. But this might be the first time we've suffered a lack of cognitive diversity across similar-minded parents when it came time to signing their children's birth certificates. In other words, it's not that kind of diversity issue. We typically release our shows in the order we record, so this scheduling falls completely on me. Thanks so much for spreading the word about the abundance of Michaels on Capital Allocators. And by the way, so as not to gloss over the real issues of diversity, we featured women on 72 of the 477 released shows on our platform, or 15% of the total. It's not a high number, but my hunch is it's in line or above the industry representation. And with that, please enjoy my conversation with Michael LaFell.
Michael, thanks so much for joining me.
That's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you take me all the way back to your upbringing?
That's going back quite a ways. I grew up in Montreal. My father was a congregational rabbi. Growing up in Quebec in the 60s and 70s was interesting, highlighted particularly by what's going on today, since there was pretty significant anti-Semitism from the Roman Catholic Church at the time. That wasn't a driving factor for us. In the late 60s and early 70s, the separatist party began to emerge in Quebec, which wanted to separate Quebec from the rest of Canada. At one time, that resulted in some terrorist kidnappings and the imposition by Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau of the martial law in Montreal and Quebec. So at a time, there were tanks and soldiers stationed all over Montreal. In any event, it became obvious, certainly by 1976 and 77, that if French was not your native language, your career opportunities in Quebec would be limited. So my brothers all went to university in the United States, as did I. And the transition going to the States from Canada was not that difficult. And quite frankly, coming from a day school, I was a little surprised that the light course load I had at university seemed easy at the time. Any conversations that we had at the table, aside from the Montreal Canadiens or Montreal Expos, focused on ideas. There was not much discussion about gossip or people. It was idea-driven.
What type of ideas?
A lot of politics, literature, history, things we were studying in school. I wouldn't say necessarily heavy, but topics of interest. And we'd have a constant stream of guests coming through the house who were guest lecturers. So there would be people coming to discuss recent archaeological digs in Jerusalem. This would be late 60s and early 70s when Israel was still pretty young. And it was a different situation in society than it has become. We'd have chancellors of universities come and tell us what was going on in their schools. So it was a pretty dynamic environment. And as the youngest of four, I tended to listen more than speak.
Of all those ideas that are around you, do you remember any of them really capturing you back then?
Not really, quite frankly. Although something must have triggered an interest in history for me, because as soon as I was ready to go off to college, it's the only thing I had interest in studying.
So once you did that at school, how did you set out on what would become your professional career?
After college, I went to law school. I got a job at a law firm. It was interesting because I had interned for a smallish firm after my second year. I continued to work there during my third year. And toward the end of that year, probably in late April, the firm announced that they were bringing in a lateral litigator to run the litigation department. By that time, I had accepted an offer from them to return after graduation as a litigator. I went and introduced myself to this gentleman, and he said, "Well, show me a resume and I'll see if we have room for you." So here I am about to graduate from law school, studying for finals. I had to worry about the bar exam, and I quickly decided I had to go find a job as well. So I had a plateful that month, and I ended up finding a job with a firm called Kay Scholer, where I practiced litigation for 4 years.
What was your path from practicing litigation to investing?
The first step was not enjoying being a litigator. I found it not very rewarding, and the hours were brutal. By a matter of serendipity, I was introduced to Marvin Davidson, who was running MH Davidson and Company at the time. I was told it was a hedge fund. I had no idea what a hedge fund was. I met Marvin and spent 45 minutes talking to him on the parlor level of a brownstone on East 63rd Street. And he said they were interested in hiring somebody to invest in the financial instruments of distressed and troubled companies. I said, okay, that sounds interesting. And as I was leaving, he said, make sure to introduce yourself to Tommy, Tom Kempner, and don't let the grass grow under your feet. I met Tommy. We spoke. They guaranteed me the same salary I'd have made as a lawyer. We shook hands, and that was it.
What was the hedge fund back then?
We had $20 million under management. I think I was the fifth professional, and it was Tommy, Marvin, Steve, Scott, and then myself. They were doing merger arbitrage, and Tommy was going to start doing some credit stuff, investing in distressed and bankrupt companies. I started there, and I was given a telephone and a Quotron machine, not even a computer. The first assignment that Tommy asked me to do was to model out the five-year financials for the Public Service Company of New Hampshire, which was then in bankruptcy because of the Seabrook nuclear reactor. And I modeled it out with a Hewlett-Packard 19B2 and an accounting ledger. And the amazing lesson from that is when I look at a spreadsheet today, I actually understand what each cell means.
And from that first project, what was the first big set of opportunities that you saw?
So that would have been 1988 that I went there. And shortly thereafter, Drexel started to go bankrupt. And then we had the savings and loan crisis. So that created a bunch of unforced sellers of bank debt and bonds. So the first big opportunity we really transacted in that was new was buying bank debt. And bank debt did not historically trade. So these were one-off transactions. It was pretty much a small group of banks and funds that were doing it. I think Goldman Sachs, Oppenheimer and Company, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns. We were there. Randy Smith was there. Maybe Chuck Davidson was playing around at Steinhardt Partners a little bit. So we started buying bank debt. And then the real entertainment came when we had the opportunity to buy an unfunded revolver. Marvin had this thing. He would call you up to his office several times for the proponent of an investment to explain it. And you'd go over it and over it and over it. And he'd pick up any difference in the presentation and question you about it. So to try to explain to somebody that you were buying an unfunded revolver at 50 cents on the dollar, and the seller is going to give you 50 cents. So if we're ever unfunded, you just pocketed 50 cents, was pretty entertaining. And we ended up doing it. But the lesson there was we were completely focused on what we were doing. We were buying senior and secured debt in bankrupt and troubled companies. The bankruptcy laws at the time entitled us to collect interest, either current or to accrue it. And if our analysis was correct, there was relatively modest risk of losing capital. The point there was to take those fundamental skills and gradually extend them into other areas. We weren't going off on adventures. We weren't going off in tangents. We were taking baby steps one at a time to extend what we did into newer areas.
What was the competitive landscape like in the early years?
I think back then there's probably more opportunities and capital chasing it. It was a club of people. There were people you'd want to invest alongside with, and there were people you would avoid. So there were some investors that I would never want to go into a transaction with. There were some types of companies or industries I'd never want to go into a transaction with. I was never really fond of gambling businesses because of issues about the licenses. We were very fond of utilities because they would always be needed.
What are some of the key things you learned from Marvin?
The first thing is always look for an advantage. What kind of edge can you get in something? So in the early years, we would have someone stationed at the SEC. And when a company we were following filed something, this person or company would take it and fax it back to us. And we had those rolls of fax paper that if you didn't read it quickly enough, the print would disappear. So you can't get that edge anymore. Information is too quick and too free-flowing. But that was a lawful edge we could get. So that's number one. The second thing was to always react to dynamics. When something changes, whether it is the legal background, the business itself, the personnel involved, or delays, something is going on. So be sensitive to that and try to figure out what. Don't just pass it off and go on to the next investment opportunity. The third thing would be always commit things to writing. That was one of the early disciplines we took on, because having something in writing creates accountability. There's no he said, she said. The analyst has committed something. You know what was said and when it was said. And if it proves out correct, great. If it proves out wrong, there's a lesson to be learned. And the final thing, I think, is to always take advantage of uncorrelated opportunities. So when you had the savings and loan crisis, banks became forced sellers of debt for regulatory reasons. They often didn't care what the price was. They had to get it off their books. We were the beneficiaries of that. We saw a similar situation recently when Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank went bust and the FDIC took over their books. The FDIC was selling it. They were giving it away at very, very advantageous prices.
What was M.H. Davidson became Davidson Kempner and has been one of the longest standing funds through a few iterations of succession. And I'd love to hear what you saw in the dynamics of the organization that allowed it to continue to succeed as long as it has.
DK just celebrated its 40th year. I think the key element there is hiring the right people, coaching them in the right way. There's a way of thinking about things. There's a way of being disciplined in what you do, of being focused in what you do, being honest, transparent, logical. It's bad news first. Don't try to hide it. It's always going to come out. Accept it. Accepting responsibility for your actions and moving forward. There was not much second guessing when something went wrong. It's what lesson can I learn from this? There's always tomorrow.
What were some of the ways you saw effective coaching of people on the team?
I think just having to go up and explain an investment idea repeatedly is a way of coaching. It's not overt coaching, but it's a way of coaching. Tell me what you think. Tell me why you think it, why we should do it, how much capital we should commit. Then do it again. Over time, you get to really know whether you have a good idea or not. The other big coaching thing here is never rush. When somebody is rushing you to make a decision, back then it was enough to say, I'm not doing it. And to this day, I won't do it. If somebody's rushing me that you have to act now on a new idea, say, well, it's tomorrow, forget about it. I'm not that interested. There's millions of investment ideas out there.
A little bit of a juxtaposition of two things you said. One is this idea of looking for the next opportunity. And then the other, sticking to what you know, how did you decide over the years what were appropriate things to move into that you hadn't been doing and which ones you wanted to avoid?
The key element is something I said earlier, which is, can we extend our core skill set into something different? So I think having been a credit guy for many years, more recently, we decided to do some venture. That was not a natural extension of the skill sets. We had to think carefully about how we were going to do that. But to go from understanding balance sheets and credit to trying to identify direct investment opportunities, it's a similar skill that you're using.
So DK is now on what, its third generation of leadership. So after you had brought in and trained your people, how did you keep them around for so long?
So I think the original structure at Davidson was created by Marvin and Tommy, and it was basically an old Wall Street partnership structure. In that respect, every partner in the firm did well if the firm did well, and did poorly if the firm did poorly. And the hope there was that if merger arbitrage is having a gangbang year, then the guys in distress where I was would not glom onto capital for mediocre ideas. We would prefer to let the arbitrage guys make a killing because we would do well financially from that. So partners were incented for the firm to do well. And at the associate level, there was generally some sort of broad band of profits that would be used to compensate the associates. Associates who were outstanding would get paid more. Associates who were less outstanding would get paid less. And associates who were even less outstanding would get paid materially less. To my knowledge, the structure has changed a little bit over time, as there are now managing directors and other interim levels between associate and partner. And I think that there are some other incentives that are put in terms of profit sharing and co-investment for the other levels. But at the end of the day, the focus was always to have all of the investment professionals be incented for the firm as a whole to do well.
You decided to retire some time ago. What was the thought process that went into that?
Well, there were two things. I guess first is, a year or two before I retired, a very good friend of mine was taking the train from Westchester County to New York, to the city. He got to Grand Central Terminal, felt pain in his left chest, got back on the train, went back to White Plains, and was rushed to the hospital with a heart attack. And that just reinforced for me that life changes on a dime. And what is the good of having a fair measure of success and not having the time to really enjoy it and use it when things can just turn on you right away? So that was part of it. Another part of it was I wanted to have more control over my time. There were other things I was interested in doing. And if you're in a partnership, I believe you have to be 100% in or not there. And if you're not 100% in, you're not doing your partners a favor and you're not doing yourself a favor. So I discussed with my partners. They had asked me to stay on for a year beyond my original target to make for an orderly transition. And it went very smoothly, I'm happy to say. And it gave me the opportunity to spend more time with my children, to really delve into some reading that I had not focused on for years, and to develop my philanthropy in a more meaningful way. The biggest concern I had when I decided to step back was intellectual engagement. At a firm like Davidson, I don't know how many people we had there at the time, probably 100 or so. And each one of them was incredibly smart and talented. They kept each other and me on my toes. And I knew that if I stepped back, I'd have to replicate that somehow because I didn't want to go and play golf 6 days a week.
Once you stepped away and you'd had some success, you now have your own balance sheet. How did you think about investing your capital on your own?
I began to look at ways to broaden my own portfolio. And I began to think about where could I find inefficiencies? Where would there be room to create an edge? And by that, I mean a serious edge. And that arena was obviously in the private markets. In those markets, we see mispricing and information asymmetry. Now, of course, you have to be on the right side of that. And that's something we spend a lot of time trying to assure we are. To create a vehicle for finding those investment opportunities, I started what originated as my family office. It was called Portage Partners. The original idea was to create a nimble vehicle that could compound my personal capital through cycles. I wanted to be diversified. I wanted to be flexible. So when we look at the private markets, some of the large investors are geared to certain strategies that incentivize them to write huge tickets irrespective of the market environment. In a way, that's indiscriminate capital deployment, which is really a big no-no in investing. It's something to avoid. Over time, we had some other investors come into the fold, and they were pretty shrewd guys who liked our model, who had all made money on their own in the markets. Each of these individuals added significant value to us. And we call them partners. Today, we have a thesis-driven focus on capacity-constrained niche exposures across all sorts of private markets. We opportunistically invest across all sectors, vehicles, but it is usually under a particular theme that unifies the investment. Some of these themes we have focused on in the past, for example, would be cybersecurity, onshoring of production and manufacturing, logistics, and multifamily real estate. every time we extend our tentacles into something new, we do it very gradually. We take baby steps to make sure we understand the area and gradually get more aggressive. The fundamental strategy is to bring institutional quality diligence to mid-market opportunities where we believe we can generate outsized returns. Over the last 12 years, I guess that has proved to be the case.
What are your favorite types of investments?
Someone who's an uneconomic seller in something that interests me. So when banks are selling because the regulators tell them they have to get stuff off their balance sheets, that's heaven. They have to sell, so they're going to take a price. And I really like that kind of opportunity, whether it's banks or fund selling. We're going to see opportunities where venture capital and private equity funds are winding down. They're at their 10-year limit. Maybe they can get another year. They're going to have to sell things. So hopefully we can be in a position to take advantage of that.
How do you conduct diligence when you're on your own?
The diligence comes in several very interesting aspects. First, you must diligence the sponsor who's bringing the idea to you. You want to do background checks on them, validate their honesty, their integrity, their transparency. You want to get a sense of whether they are good investors, what's the quality of their diligence. And to do this, the team meets with the sponsor several times. And before we actually make an investment, I have a face-to-face meeting with them. Then we would also diligence the specifics of the idea, the thesis of the idea. Is it something that makes sense to us? Is it in a geographic area that we understand? So if somebody brings us an opportunity in Spain, I'm less likely to jump on it than if somebody brings us an opportunity to redevelop garden apartments in South Carolina. It all drives down to who's bringing the idea and what's the nature of the thesis behind it. If we can get comfortable with those two things, then I will often do a test transaction with the sponsor to validate how they work and how we work with them. Is their reporting good? Are they responsive to our questions? Do they talk to us? You would be surprised at the number of sponsors who, once they get your money as an investor, don't really want to pick up the phone. And we would be remiss to put our investors and our partners in a situation where a sponsor doesn't want to speak with us. Once the investment is made, there's ongoing work in monitoring it that requires quarterly calls or biannual calls with the sponsor, following up on the performance. Does the performance that's being reported track with the performance that they had underwritten? If not, why not? If so, why is it doing as well or better than expected? If there's a problem, how are they working on it? How are they working it out? It's mostly when there's a problem that we get really involved and start pushing the sponsor to force a resolution.
How do potential investments fall off your radar in the process?
There's about five or six things that are really important to understand whether something's a no-go. First off, if we're looking at a sponsor and there's two partners and they've never worked together before, that's something I'm always apprehensive about. I think that one of them will not be there in 6 months, and I don't want that institutional risk. Along the same vein, when there are two partners who are co-chiefs, who's the ultimate decision maker? If in meeting them there's not a clear answer to that, that's a red flag. We also always ask more about the mistakes they've made and what they've learned rather than their winners. If there's reluctance to discuss mistakes or what they've learned from them or what the lesson is, that's not really a good sign about their intellectual honesty or transparency. Of course, we also looked at whether our interests are aligned. Are they investing alongside us? And are the fees that they are taking out much greater than the capital investment they're actually making? And with respect to that capital investment, is it actually cash invested, or are they just not taking their fees out? Finally, there's something having to do with misleading marketing information. Are they cherry-picking data? Are their graphs and charts skewed so as to obfuscate what really happened? And the last thing would be any inconsistent or question marks raised on the background checks.
What's an example of a recent investment you made?
We invested recently in a medical device fund where the guys came out of some large medical device companies. And as they explained it to us, their friends at the large device companies would say, "We're looking for a new ankle." So they would go and find the three or four firms that are developing new ankles. They would choose the best one, try to take a controlling stake, build it up from X dollar of revenues to Y dollar of revenues to make it of interest to the big guys, and then they'd sell it. So in some ways, it's like a retained search. They know exactly what they're looking for. They know who the end buyer is. So if they can do it right, they're going to have this enterprise with all the I's dotted and T's crossed for FDA purposes and sell it to the big guys.
What are some of the things that you'd like to be able to do, maybe in terms of resources or research, that's just harder to do because you don't have the resources?
I think that as we expand and we're about to, having more investment research skills would be helpful to dig deeper into some of the funds. Because when we do research, we're not just looking at their due diligence documents. We want to go into the companies they've invested in. We're interested in what the metrics are of those companies, how they're performing, what value add the firm is bringing to it, and whether they're marking it appropriately. So that's important for us as well.
I want to take a break in the action to tell you about NetSuite by Oracle, helping businesses accelerate growth and run better with a suite of ERP, financial, CRM, and e-commerce products. Here are three numbers for you to remember: 36,000, 25, and 1. 36,000 is the number of businesses that have been upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite turns 25 years old this year. That's 25 years helping businesses do more with less, close their books in days, and drive down costs. And 1, because your business is one of a kind. Get a customized solution for all your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. Manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. Everything you need, all in one place. Right now, download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance, absolutely free, at netsuite.com/allocators. That's netsuite.com/allocators to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/allocators. And now, back to the show.
You mentioned that one of the key disciplines you had was writing up ideas, and I'd love to hear, what does your write-up look like today?
For me, it has to be shorter than what I'm given. I think, quite frankly, if somebody cannot communicate an intelligent investment idea in one page, they should go back and do it again. There's no reason, certainly, for an intelligent executive summary to be more than a page long, and I'm not talking about 8-point type with quarter-inch margins. I think the write-up typically would have a one-page executive summary of who the sponsor is, how much capital they're looking for, what the opportunity set is, what the expected return is, what the downside is, and who the people are. And the subsequent pages would go into more detail about that.
In your own organization, you mentioned that there were some lessons you had learned from how to structure an organization at DK and create incentives to keep people around. How did you set that up in your internal family office?
I think it's similar. We look at how the firm in general does, and everyone's individual contribution is, of course, extremely relevant to how they are personally compensated, but it still has to be how the firm is done. We take into account the way people work together, their personal contributions to the success. But at both Davidson and here, I think one of the key elements to retaining talented people is to create a tableau where people have a sense that they will be doing something different and more challenging tomorrow than they are doing today. If somebody thinks they're going to be doing the same thing every day by rote, there's not much incentive to really wake up in the morning and dig your teeth into it. So I think you have to create opportunities where people know that as something grows, their responsibilities will grow, and they'll continue to be intellectually and professionally challenged down the road.
Canoe Software came out of your original efforts. I'd love to hear the story of how that came about.
So back in 2013, we'd begun to assemble a portfolio of alternative investments. If you own stocks and bonds, it's pretty easy to go to Goldman Sachs or Schwab and see what you own. If you own real estate and funds and venture capital opportunities and direct investments, there was no way to track those. So we hired an engineer and taught him about the investment business to track these investments, and he created a very nice monitor for us. In the course of doing that, he stumbled upon a way to extract all sorts of data from any type of document, whether it's a PDF, an email, a text message, or anything. And then he could spit back that data in any format you wanted. He could take the data and give it to me in an Excel format if that's what I wanted. It dawned on the people at the time that if you have invested in 20 different funds and you get a quarterly letter from each one, and each has 10 data points, that's 200 data points that would typically be manually input. And if we could extract it automatically, that's something meaningful. So instead of doing something that was beneficial for me, tracking my investments, they decided they had something which is more of a business-to-business opportunity and completely shifted the direction of the firm. We spun it out, raised money for it on three separate occasions. The most recent was February 2023. The enterprise called Canoe Intelligence now has 140 employees, offices in New York and London. Its customer base is comprised of blue chip banks, asset managers, administrators, and it's only getting better.
So Canoe's not the only business that seems to be coming out of your original family office activities. One that I've gotten involved with you over the last couple of years, 10 East, and I'd love to hear the whole impetus behind it.
Several years ago, we realized that the demand for what Portage had been doing was growing. That demand was driven by the fact of shrinking opportunities in public markets with increased competition, compounded by limited access to private markets, which is very resource intensive. To have a really diversified portfolio, then, I think it's clear that alternatives or private investments have to be part of it. Our track record over the previous decade has been pretty strong, and we had de-risked our thesis in many ways. So here we were, we had this great track record, and we had built up a very deep bench of talented investment partners. And the rebrand to 10 East was just a natural extension of what we had been doing for the previous decade or so.
We hired Travis Stevens, who was at business school at the time, and he did a market study and concluded that there were a bunch of other firms out there who were selling alternative investments using financial technology. Those firms had all raised a lot of money from venture capitalists, and none of them were investors. They were all techies. And the key difference from them to what we do is the quality of our investments were materially better. We had an institutional approach. We were focused. We diligenced them on our own. And some people think this is highly relevant, but I personally invest in everything that we do. Travis Stevens then came and joined us full-time. Then we hired Jay Gregory to be our COO, and we built a customer service business. 10 East is a way for individuals to participate in the same investments, basically, except they do it on a pay-as-you-go basis. They pay fees that vary depending on the particular investment. What has driven this in large part is that private markets are increasingly becoming a focal point for sophisticated investors and their portfolios. So these dynamics all combine to create an opportunity for Portage to expand beyond its core families. We started 10 East to create a community of sophisticated investors who could curate their own alternative portfolios from our opportunities. We are seeing incredible enthusiasm from our membership in this, because they are seeing opportunities that they would not get from JP Morgan or Citibank or Goldman Sachs. And that's not in any way to disparage those firms. they have a different priority. They have to put items in their private bank that can sell to their entire network. We're interested in our smaller opportunities. So in that respect, we're very different from the large institutional banks. Our members will derive the benefits from a community-based ecosystem flywheel, high quality and well-vetted deal flow, and that will in turn attract more sophisticated clients. This increased purchasing power opens up new sourcing opportunities and the ability to hire more people to diligence better.
So as that flywheel starts spinning, what have you seen on changes in sourcing of these ideas?
It's a little early to tell right now, but I think we're seeing more incoming calls from people wanting to get exposure to us and asking us to look at things.
Is there anything different in what you've described from the years at Portage in terms of the breadth of what you want to look at as you're offering it more broadly?
At this point, I would say no. But given my experience, I don't rule anything out. There are things I will rule out. We're not going to invest in China. We're not going to invest in the Far East. We're not going to go to Latin America. Certainly not Russia. We will only invest in places where the rule of law is recognized. We will not invest in things where we don't claim to have any kind of expertise.
How do you think about the alignment of what you and your team are doing with these members?
The alignment is pretty clear. All the team members have a huge stake in the equity value of what we're doing. We're not taking cash out to pay big salaries or bonuses. We're taking the cash to build the team and to build research. And again, the key effort here is that we invest directly in the exact same things. We're not putting things out there to generate fees. We're not salesmen, and that should be obvious from hearing me speak.
What are some examples of things that you've gotten really excited about within this new construct?
One of the things that I really get excited about are private credit situations. So for example, a few years ago, someone came to us and described how the truck manufacturers in Europe had all signed a consent decree with the European Union, admitting that they had conspired to fix the price of certain types of trucks. And then these investors came and said, we're raising a small fund. We're doing it privately, and we have a large hedge fund co-investing with us to go and find the claims of the truck purchasers who were hurt by that conspiracy. So I'm saying to myself, I have the opportunity to buy claims where liability is admitted, and I just have to prove damages. That sounds pretty interesting. Now, the risk there is the liability was incurred back in 2001 through 2003, well before today's digital age. So somebody had to figure out how to go and get the invoices and talk to the purchasing people about those trucks. But assuming that could happen, this presented a very interesting opportunity. And it would not be heavily exploited because it would have to be litigated in several different countries. So it wouldn't have the immediacy that a lot of funds require. So that was fun. That was interesting to me. More recently, we've had success in some other domestic litigation finance where we don't bet really on having a slice of the equity of the ultimate outcome. We would finance a law firm, for example, in the Boy Scout litigation. We knew there was going to be a settlement. It was going to be X billion dollars. And you knew there was somewhere between Y and Z number of claims, and that each claim would be worth some dollar amount, call it somewhere between $5,000 and $10,000 per claimant. So the game for the law firms was to go and collect as many claimants as they could. So we were able to make a loan to a law firm, and we were secured by the value of the claims that they were amassing. I think we had 9-to-1 collateral coverage. And it generated a better than 20% return in a year and a half. So I like those kinds of things because they're completely asymmetric. The law firm didn't care about paying us 20% because they were going to make so much money anyways.
When the landscape has gotten so much more competitive from what was just a small group of people doing this years ago to today, I'm curious how you think about the competitive advantage that you can bring to these opportunities.
I think the main value driver of what we do resides in our discipline and focus. When you combine that focus with our institutional quality diligence and the opportunity to share our ideas with investment professionals and derive their intellectual capital and thoughts on those ideas, that creates a rather dynamic investing situation. Many of our partners are in and of themselves very successful investment professionals, whether in real estate or hedge funds or debt or what have you. And they bring all that investment expertise and experience when we're discussing an opportunity.
Where do you hope 10 East goes in the ensuing years?
Well, that's an interesting question for me to answer. I usually don't know what I'm going to wear to work the next day, so thinking about how a business will evolve over the years is a little bit of a challenge. Having said that, I think the place to begin is about the quality of our membership. We're seeing investors come in from so many top institutions in finance, and that's a great signal about the fact that we have something tangible here. So really the key question is, how do you solve for enduring performance and create broader access to that without the trade-off that comes with scale? We see the answer really as being choice and solving for choice. And in that regard, letting our members pick and choose what makes sense for them. That may be higher octane deals, it may be lower risk exposures, but everyone is different. And that's why our flexibility matters so much. Over the last 10 or so years, we've learned that not everyone opts into the same opportunities. So I'm not really concerned about having to scale up our bespoke opportunities to deal with huge demand.
So alongside of these ideas and a lot of it with partners, you dabbled, as it were, back onto a distress board. So we'd love to hear how you got involved in PG&E and that experience.
There were some people I thought were my friends who had equity in PG&E right before it went bankrupt. They had persuaded the PG&E board that it had to be changed, and they asked me if I would go on the board as one of several new directors. And I said, sure, it sounds interesting. I went on the board, and it was a rude introduction to doing business in California. We had a very deep and detailed lesson that went on virtually every week for a few hours, learning about the Camp Fire, where several people unfortunately were killed, and the reason for the PG&E liability for that fire. We came to the conclusion rather quickly that we had to settle. Trying to fight this in court would not be a winning opportunity. And we settled first with Baupost, which made an absolutely brilliant investment by purchasing the subrogated claims of the insurance companies. And we settled with them for close to par. And then we put together a settlement with the Camp Fire victims themselves with their law firms, and company pled guilty. And this is right around COVID hitting, March 2020. And the governor had insinuated his staff into the process and was very engaged in what we were doing and insisted that the entire board change after bankruptcy. Now, I don't know why the governor was picking on our board since we had just paid off everybody, but he insisted that everyone change. And some people on the board persuaded his representatives that getting rid of 14 directors was not the smartest thing. We had to keep at least three. I had the fortune of being chairman of the governance and nominating committee. And when I said yes, never in my life did I imagine I would have to find 11 directors between April and May to change come June. We had two different firms working for us, and we were actually reporting to the governor's lawyers at the time, where the governor's lawyers were involved in the selection process. And we had some really good candidates. Needless to say, we had to be consistent with certain California DEI initiatives, and that was fine. But what really sticks out is we had the resume of a retired Navy admiral who had commanded, I believe, a nuclear aircraft carrier or submarine. So he was nuclear certified. He was cybersecurity certified. And if anyone has ever been on a nuclear sub or an aircraft carrier, they're very complex, dangerous machines. So bringing that back to PG&E, running a utility is a very complex and dangerous business. PG&E has a nuclear reactor that it would have to decommission. And like all utilities, PG&E is subject to cyber attack. So this guy was a dream director. And when his name came up, the California governor's representative said, quote, he's just another Army guy. Not even Navy. They didn't read his resume. Just another Army guy. That floored me. Personally, I have incredible respect for everyone who serves in our military and all branches of it. When you meet them personally, you realize the skill, the talent, the commitment, the brain power that they have. And to be so dismissive is just incredibly offensive. And I think reflects very poorly on the state and the lawyers themselves who were selected by the governor to represent them.
So what'd you do?
We hired him.
How long did you stay involved on the board?
I was off by the end of June 2020. All these interviews were done on Zoom. It was an incredible process.
Touch a little bit on philanthropy, and I'd love to hear a little more about your engagement.
We created a foundation in 1999, and the vast majority of the effort goes to Jewish education and dealing with Israel. This is going back to 2000, well before the current situation. And we spend a lot of time teaching people in the diaspora about the importance and centrality of Israel to their Jewish peoplehood. Obviously, after October 7th, there were immediate short-term and long-term needs. So we dealt with the short-term needs with a very quick grant to UJA Federation of New York. Some people were advocating that we should go and look for different organizations on the ground in Israel, and I didn't want to waste my time doing that. I felt that the Federation had teams on the ground. They knew where the money was needed. They would be the best capital allocators for that. I'm actually going to Israel to take a look and get a better understanding of what the long-term needs are going to be. And I think those long-term needs are going to be focused primarily on the dislocated refugees within Israel who cannot right now go back to their homes in the south near Gaza or up north near Lebanon.
Michael, I want to make sure I get a chance to ask you a couple of closing questions. What is your favorite hobby or activity outside of work and family?
I really like woodworking. I enjoy crafting things. I think that there's a certain satisfaction that I derive from starting something with literally a piece of wood and seeing what it looks like at the end. It's physical, it's tangible, it's right there. And I can leave it for 3 months and then come back to it and it hasn't moved. There's no change at all.
What's one fact that most people don't know about you?
Apart from woodworking. I guess most people might be surprised that I played hockey for 50 years. I played hockey growing up right through college. And then we had a game up here in Westchester. And that was pretty good also because the people who played range from beginners to Division I players, from firemen and policemen and electricians to bankers and lawyers and doctors. And when you get on the ice, everyone's the same. So it's humbling and brings you back to your roots.
What's your biggest pet peeve?
On the investment side, my pet peeve is when somebody comes to me and says, this is the best thing out there. And my response is, I don't care. I want to know if it's really the best thing in absolute terms. Subjective quality doesn't work for me. And the other thing I don't like is failure to accept responsibility. I don't like it when somebody tells me it's always somebody else's fault. Accept it, learn from it, and move on.
Which two people had the biggest impact on your professional life?
I would say it's probably Marvin Davidson and Tom Kempner. I think they showed a way of investing, discipline, thoroughness, intellect, honesty, transparency, a certain sense of humility that you wouldn't expect. Marvin would teach that the best way to generate wealth is compounded returns and avoid loss. Stop looking for the greener field. Stick to what you know and you'll be fine.
What's the best advice you've ever received?
Show up and be diligent. In the military, they say, if you're on time, you're 5 minutes late.
All right, Michael, one more. What life lesson have you learned that you wish you knew a lot earlier in life?
I think it's perspective. I think it's understanding that when you're in the heat of things, in the heat of the moment, and the world's on fire, you tend to think everything's going to hell in a handbasket. It's not. There's always tomorrow. Things settle down. You don't know how things will shake out. So try to remain calm, and it'll work out.
Well, Michael, thanks so much for sharing your long journey and these new opportunities with 10 East.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate the chance.
Thanks for listening to the show. To learn more, hop on our website at capitalallocators.com, where you can join our mailing list, access past shows, learn about our gatherings, and sign up for premium content, including podcast transcripts, my investment portfolio, and a lot more. Have a good one, and see you next time.